Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. The voice of freedom behind enemy lines in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Doing my best to equip you, the patriots, the information you need to stay in the fight for your liberty. This is episode 21-11, the 11th episode of 2021. And this year is trucking right along. We're 3 months in, and you're already paying 50 cents more a gallon for gas since Bumbles was installed as president. I did some math, and my van's consumption at work is going to cost the company, that 50 cents is going to cost the company $800 more dollars a year, which will impact things like the company's growth, our bonuses, lots of different things. Elections have consequences, and usually not in a good way. And stealing elections has even bigger consequences. Something I saw really creepy, jump right in here, the other day, was driving through Lynchburg. I had to stop and get some office supplies. And next to the Staples is the Lynchburg Vaccination Center. I wonder what they'll use that for if they pass this some of these laws getting people to turn in their guns. Because you got a lot of really big bunch of dumb sheep out there who would be glad to drive on down and go, well, I got to obey the law. I got to obey the law. What's the law say? Oh, the new law was passed. I have to turn in my guns. Let me go run on down there and turn them on in. But it's pretty shocking. Think about this. You're thinking about getting the virus. Good one. You're thinking about getting the vaccine. When in the history of mankind have we ever created a vaccine for an RNA-based virus? That's the type of virus that the coronavirus is. When? The answer? Never. Until now. And miraculously, although it's been never in the history of man until now, we've supposedly created more than four different vaccines. And the here's the kicker. If you believe they actually work, they don't work 100%. You can still get the dang thing. Now, so why on earth would you go get that? You can still get the virus. Oh, it's just going to lessen your symptoms. Then that's not a vaccine. It's shocking to me. It shouldn't be, but it really shouldn't. But it's shocking to me how quickly people are willing to turn their brains off and do whatever somebody says. Okay, so one of the big laws that we've been following on this show and other places is marijuana legalization. And at the moment, it has passed the House and the Senate. There were some changes made. One of them was at the Senate level, and this was agreed upon, was that they would send it to the voters for to get their opinion. I'm going to read this to you because it's completely pointless. Should the state legalize the sale of recreational marijuana from privately licensed retailers, wholesalers, and growers for use by adults? The ballot shall be prepared, distributed, and voted on. Blah, blah, blah. Here's why this is pointless. The results of this referendum shall be advisory only. So they're going to do whatever they want anyway. They don't care what you think. They don't care what's right. And it's this way with every law, not just this law. They don't care. But they're going to put out a referendum so that they can ignore us and just do whatever they want anyway. It's insulting. But It is passed. It has not been signed by the governor yet. I expect it will be. And this will essentially decriminalize the use of marijuana in Virginia. So I'm going to dive in a little bit on this because I think it's important you understand how laws work and how laws are written. And the reason is that this is really about control. They just want to change the control from criminalization to really just a different form of control. Really, I guess what you'd say is criminalization and converting it to monetization. So they want to monetize people using marijuana in Virginia, whereas right now they're not getting any benefit. It's actually costing them money. So they're looking to shift it from criminalization to monetization. And there's still some criminalization in here. And that's if you don't follow their rules and work so that they can monetize it and they can collect their taxes, then you're going to pay. So while the proposal repeals and enlists a section of the law related to the manufacture and distribution of marijuana, the proposal establishes a number of new misdemeanor and felony offenses for engaging in these activities without the required license or otherwise engaging in prohibited practices related to the production, sale, etc. of marijuana. For example, cultivation and manufacture of marijuana, it's not really manufacture, it's growing. Manufacture of marijuana without a license would be a Class 6 felony. So if you're just cooking this stuff up in your basement with your hydroponic setup, Class 6 felony. Unless you get the license, and I'm going to see if I can find that in here, what the process is for making that happen, which they may not even written that yet, because it's a four-year process. 2024 is when all of this will all shake out completely. Violation of home cultivation laws, which would allow individuals to grow up to 4 marijuana plants for personal use. 4 plants. My goodness. Would be a Class 6 felony if the individual were cultivating 50 to 100 plants or if the individual were cultivating more than 100 plants. Wait a sec. So you can grow up to 4 plants, but it's going to be a Class 6 felony if you're growing 50 to 100 plants. Well, what if I'm growing 49 plants? Possession of more than 1 pound of marijuana on one's person or in a public place would also be a felony punishable by 1 to 10 years. So if you're rolling around in your trunk that's got a kilo of marijuana, you're still going to get in trouble. The distribution or sale of marijuana without a license would be a Class 2 misdemeanor for the first offense and a Class 1 misdemeanor for the second and subsequent offense. However, sale of marijuana to a person who is under the age of 21 or intoxicated would be a Class 1 misdemeanor. Okay, so under 21 or a drunk person. Again, the dumbest people on earth write some of these laws. And this is, of course, the summary, but still written by those same dumb people. In addition, the proposal expands section of the law to make it a Class 6 felony to operate an aircraft while under the influence of marijuana. Well, at least they're looking out for us, you know? And make it a Class 1 misdemeanor to carry a concealed handgun while under the influence of marijuana. Finally, the proposal, this is interesting. So finally, the proposal would establish a mechanism for incarcerated persons serving time for certain marijuana offenses to petition the court for a reduction in sentence. The proposal would also provide for the expungement of prior marijuana arrests, charges, convictions, adjudication, and civil offense records under certain circumstances. It's all about control. They don't care. If they really care, if they really believed what they say this law is attempting to do, they would just say, all right, everyone that's been charged with this and is in jail right now, boom, you're out. You're done. You're good to go. But they don't. This is about control. That's all this is. Like I said, they're criminalization to monetization. They don't care. There's still a bunch of criminal stuff in here. And now it's just about, hey, you screwed up our chances to monetize it. So, hey, here's another felony or here's a misdemeanor for you. And ultimately, I'd like to give you more information on a specifically, hey, maybe you want to set up a growing operation. You want to grow and get licensed and do all that. Well, unfortunately, there's no information on that. And I've dug and dug and dug and I cannot find it anywhere. If you find it, send it to me. I would like to talk about that on the show. It's But it's not here. It just says the proposal would establish a licensing and regulation system for cannabis cultivation facilities, but it doesn't anywhere talk about what that will be. When I find out, I will share that information. But I think this law, and the reason I keep talking about this, is one, fairly libertarian in this regard. I think you're stupid for putting this poison in your body. But how is that different than other poisons we legally allow you to put in your body? Alcohol, tobacco, whatever. So this is just another example of government not really expanding freedom, but just expanding control. It's kind of just shifting what the control is. So it is, it will be interesting to see how this goes and how this all shakes out. I think we could look to Colorado as a picture, but you know, the problem is it's still federally illegal, at which you could probably see changing in the near future, but it's federally illegal. And as a result, if you set up a business selling this stuff through the state, you are going to have to deal with a cash business, which means essentially you're going to have to launder your money. You got to pay the tax on it. So it's a very complicated thing. It's just a very, very complicated thing. I would love, if you know somebody that is dialed in on this topic, I'd love to have him on as a guest. So send him my way. RadioFreeVA.com. They can get the contact form there and shoot me a message. I'd like to talk to somebody that can understand what on earth any of this means, because I can't make heads or tails of it. And that's the gist of it. I've talked about all the other laws that have been passed. So far, the governor, or more on oath of a governor, has not vetoed a single one. So that means anything that I've talked about at this point has essentially been signed or will be signed. The legislative session is currently over. It is done. There's possibility that there'll be a special session. Who knows? And there's all these rumors. They're saying, well, they're gonna hold a special session on guns. No, they're not. I predict no, they are not. The reason I predict no, they're not, is because they learned a valuable lesson. They learned that when you go after a patriot's guns, it's about the only thing that will get him off of his lazy, fat butt to actually do anything. So what did we see the last time they went after guns? We saw the rise of the militia. What happened as soon as they stopped going after guns? Well, the militia pretty much went away. Prove me wrong. Where is the militia? What are they doing? When are they training? Because talking about training, that's not training. Training is training. And speaking of training, I was thinking about something today. One of the problems the militia has always had is attracting ex-military people, especially special forces guys. And these guys are the best of the best, right? And regular military guys, pretty awesome. You know, give me some infantry guys. That'd be great. But a guy who, or gal, who was serious about soldiering, takes one look at these people who don't ever PT and are never gonna PT and says, I can't do it. And they go off and they work with their own mutual assistance group. They start their own thing with their other, you know, veteran friends who are serious about soldiering. So they're not going after guns. They're just not, because it would lead to militia is actually reforming. Frankly, where we're at right now is probably a good thing that they're kind of petering out, because they kicked us all off of social media. So now the intel sources that they had at their disposal just aren't there. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, you do see that, I hope. you know, remember, it's all about meet space. It's all about face to face. You know, don't be doing this stuff on social media. Don't be blasting out, you know, come get some Molon Ave. You know, just gray man. Hey, so I went to the range today with some friends. We did some range work on the range, cleaned out some trees, and doing some stuff, not shooting as much as I'd like, obviously, because, you know, at $1 a trigger pull, a little too painful. So was doing some shooting and had an out of battery detonation. And I've seen two of these happen to people. I've never actually had it happen to me. Not fun, I can tell you. Feels like the gun has exploded in your face. That's what it feels like. Was laying prone, you know, threw the gun forward and started checking myself to see if I was bleeding. asked the guys, hey, is my face okay? Yeah, very unusual. You wouldn't think an AR could do that. I didn't think it could do it until I saw it for the first time. But it can. And if it doesn't do a full cycle, doesn't chamber that round all the way, and say there's about a quarter inch sticking out, you actually pull that trigger, it can still fire. I was really surprised. It was on my 18-inch 223 Wild, W-Y-L-D-E, and which is essentially a tight 223 chamber. And it was a mix magazine. My mix magazines, I put a piece of blue tape on them just to know, okay, this is a bunch of different type of ammo. So I don't know if it was reloads, if it was factory, I had no idea. My suspicion is it's going to be a reload once it's all done. I had to actually take the rifle apart. It was just I had to pull the barrel off. I mean, it was a challenge, let me tell you. And did eventually get it out, but not fun. So joined that small fraternity of people. One of them's a good friend, and he, I was running safety when it happened to him. And sometimes if you've got a lot of rounds in the mag, actually the force will pretty much destroy the mag. Everything goes flying out, cracks your mags. My mag's cracked, you know, and it's pretty wild to see. Well, I'd like to thank Acticare of the Blue Ridge for sponsoring this show, acticare.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Bedford, Roanoke, Smith Mountain Lake, out in the country, Campbell County, Lynchburg, give them a call. Get in touch with them, acticare.com/blue-ridge. Get in touch with John and his staff, and they will take good care of you and your loved one. Well, we continue our reading of the saga of Herbert Philbrick as he continues to infiltrate the Communist Party, getting more and more deep inside the inner workings of this organization and giving us a picture of what it was like then and how similar it is to what it's like now. Chapter 14, Espionage. The preparations for the coming crisis of capitalism took on a new note of urgency in the party directions that came into district headquarters after the elections. For more than a year since the autumn of 1945, the Education Commission under Jack Stachel, of which I was a member in the New England district, had hammered away at basic training in Marxism for party members in every branch, cell, and neighborhood. Marxist theory had been pumped under high pressure into the party's bloodstream as an antidote to Browder anemia. The main effort during this period was to purge the deviationists and weaklings and to realign the party with its historic Marxist-Leninist doctrines. As early as August 1946, the party was able to take note of its success in rooting up Browderism and to declare, "We have demolished the whole rotten structure." In every segment of the party, the level of understanding had been raised, and party members who survived the Great Purge now clearly understood that their organization was no mere reform association, but a revolutionary party of the people. The ideological training in Marxist indoctrination must continue, we were told, especially for the benefit of new members. But the new educational directives, which from my vantage point as an educational director I was among the first to see, ordered a new ingredient added to the training fare. Now, we were told in effect, it was time to come down from the ideological to a more practical level and to translate the theories we learned in the historic communist text into terms of contemporary realism. We must bring down to earth the lofty language of Marx and Lenin and make it more understandable. Manny Blum opened his new phase of our educational work with a series of meetings, most of which were held at the little building, either in district headquarters or in a separate third-floor conference room. Now, he told us with particular emphasis, was the time to spread out from the hardened, thoroughly indoctrinated core of the Communist Party into circles where the party's sphere of influence could be broadened. One of my assignments was to assist in the preparation of an extensive study outline for distribution throughout the district. I worked on this job with Comrade Francis, one of the party's plain Janes, a heavy-set, studious, and serious girl whose party name I discovered was Francis Smith, but whose real name I knew to be something different. The study outline was drawn up under the title Prosperity and Depression in Capitalist Society. It sought to analyze American capitalism as viewed by Marx, and to set forth, in the simple language of quantitative propaganda, the theory of underconsumption, to prove to the man of limited education that periodic economic crises are inevitable under capitalism. We used pictures, cartoons, figures, charts, graphs, and diagrams to dramatize the pamphlet. We showed that the worker is always on the short end of the economic stick, and that salvation is possible only under socialism. It was not openly a revolutionary tract, but it did hammer and chip away at the foundation of free enterprise with unremitting cries of crisis, crisis, crisis. It clearly pointed the way to socialism, which party teachers said in secret sessions could only come about by violent revolution, carried out by bands of armed workers. And Fabian socialism, the party traditionally held, is but the first step to communism. At party headquarters, while this intensified educational campaign was getting underway, I noted an odd change in the atmosphere. Time after time, when I went to the little building on party missions, I found the district headquarters more crowded than in former days. But there was no sound of voices. An eerie quiet prevailed. Whereas formerly, those on party business discussed their affairs openly and in normal conversational tones, now they were always whispering, drawn together in tight little groups of three or four in the corners of the rooms, exchanging confidences. In this atmosphere resembling a displaced funeral parlor, Daniel Boone Schirmer took over as my immediate party superior, and it was with him as chairman of the District Educational Commission that I began to work most closely. Boone, as he was called, further contributed to the sensation that a conspiracy was hatching. He was tall and lanky, with a look of hollow frailty that his toughness belied, and he proudly claimed direct descent from Daniel Boone. He had drawn cheeks, high-boned features, deep-set eyes, and straight black hair. He looked like a woodman living off the lean of the land. We understood that he was financially secure, but his resources, if any, were kept hidden. His eyes were his most striking feature. They seemed darker in their recesses than they really were. They burned with a steady gleam, undimmed even in his quiet moments. Boone's power and zeal were such that he seemed to be in action even when he sat perfectly still. He rarely smiled, and I never heard him laugh outright. His moods ranged narrowly from passive resentment to nostril-flaring rage. Boone's single passion was the Communist Party, and his intensity frequently overruled his good sense, so that he was led into grave tactical errors. He was, to me, the most dangerous of all party types, an antagonist who had an unwavering obedience and subservience to his masters. But it was built on something other than fear. Boone knew no fear. One evening when the party headquarters was empty, save for Schirmer and me, he pulled from his pocket a rumpled, handwritten outline. "I need 50 copies of this form," he said. "Get it on a stencil and run it off. I'll help you." I inserted a mimeograph stencil in a typewriter and went to work. The form had no title. It appeared to be a questionnaire dealing with individual party members and started out with name, address, branch or cell, length of time in the party, education, special training, union member. What union? But as my eye traveled down the sheet, I became aware that this was something more than a routine questionnaire. Its scope gradually widened. Number of members in union. Number working in shop. Union officers. Number of Communist Party members. Then it became notably inquisitive. Production facilities. Types of equipment in shop. Products manufactured. Capacity. Plainly, this was more than a personal survey. It was an industrial study of manufacturing plant facilities and their products. As I cut and stencil and read it, I wondered why Shermer should need only 50 copies, unless it was to involve only that many plants. Important plants, perhaps. Boone stood over my shoulder as I worked, watching me closely. It was impossible for me to slip out the fibrous backing sheet for my FBI report. After the stencil was cut, I went into the reception room, Shermer at my heels, placed the stencil on the mimeograph, and ran off a few test copies. The machine was over-inked, and the copies came out badly smeared. I started to toss the first sheets into the wastebasket, hoping to retrieve one of them later. "Don't throw them away," Shermer flared. "But they aren't any good," I protested. "Never mind that, I'll take them. Now run off 50 good copies." He watched me turn them out. "Good. Give me the stencil. I may need some more copies." I wrapped the ink-soaked stencil in mimeograph paper and gave it to him. "I have some more work to do," he said by way of dismissal. "Thanks for your help." We made arrangements to meet next day for some other work. It was not necessary for Shermer to tell me to keep quiet about the form job. I could see that something important to the party was underway. As soon as I was out of the office, I contacted Hal Leary. While the curious form I had typed was still fresh in my mind, I informed him of the stepping up of party labor activities, and in particular, the Shermer questionnaire. "When will they be used?" was the agent's query. "I don't know for sure, but there is going to be a party builders conference in a few days, and I'll bet my last dollar it's connected with that. Are you going?" "I don't know. It's going to be tight. Tighter than most. Invitation only. They're bringing in people from all over the district. Joe Figueredo from Fall River, Oki from Worcester, Sid from Springfield, Chase from New Hampshire. They all have ties with industry, big manufacturing plants." "Try to get there if you possibly can," Hal said. It was about as close as the Bureau ever came to giving me direct orders. And it was a tip-off to me, from the FBI too, that the party meeting was to be something more than a mere conference. But there was little that I could do. Even to have hinted that I wanted to be there, much less ask, would have automatically generated great suspicion. I kept myself visible by completing a few odd projects at hand, and as luck would have it, I received one of the coveted invitations to the announced secret meeting. Only then, by virtue of my position as a member of the Malden branch exec. Thus it was that on February 2, 1947, I walked up the broad flight of treadworn wooden stairs on Huntington Avenue in Boston, and into the drab, dingy Ritz Plaza Hotel. I found the Party Builders Conference to be a workers' meeting, attended by about 100 party members. But these were not the party thinkers, the threadbare Marxist ideologists with whom I had become accustomed to dealing with in the party ranks. These were the callous-handed labor leaders of shop and industrial branches and cells, the proletarian zealots with small theoretical understanding but big biceps and boiler factory voices. Outside of the top district and branch leadership, those summoned to the conference were almost all representatives of cells in heavy industry. They were selected for the influence they wielded with their fellow workers, communists and non-communists. In addition, there were a number of men who held key posts in the party's foreign language groups, and the babble of many tongues was heard throughout the cheerless hall. Manny Blum opened the session in the early morning with an address that bore heavily on the need for increasing the party's membership and set the theme of the meeting. "More important than numbers," Manny said, "was the influence of the party in key industries." Over and over again throughout the long day, the note was repeated. The basic industries, the key industrial plants, direct our attention and activities toward becoming a party rooted among the decisive workers of New England. The program also stressed the importance of a special sub-report on communist work in the shops, to be given by Joe Figueredo, branch organizer from the heavily industrialized Fall River, New Bedford area of Massachusetts. This was a conference called ostensibly to open a new drive for membership, but it was significant that in 1947, with the new stresses rapidly developing in the world, and the Communist Party already emphasizing its work among the ranks of labor, that now the key basic industries should be so heavily underscored. Joe Figueredo's report turned out to be a disappointment, a routine address full of dogmatisms that signified to me the absence of originality in the party's second-string leadership. As he droned on, I glanced around the room to discover that I knew comparatively few of those assembled. I saw Boone Shermer, Margot Clark, Max Weitzman, and a few others of long acquaintance. One of my favorite characters was present, Elba Chase Nelson of the New Hampshire State Organization, the Little Russian Yankee who always delighted audiences by her mixture of regional expression and Marxist doctrine, which came out in her corn-cracking voice, something like, "We cannot fiddle-faddle any longer with fascist imperialism." Elba was proud that one of her sons had become the Communist Party chairman for the state of Georgia, and when her husband Fred Chase died, she emblazoned on his tombstone a huge hammer and sickle, much to the dismay of the townspeople of Washington, New Hampshire. But most of those in the hall were strangers to me, and it was plain that the new element was assuming greater importance in the eyes of the party leaders. Fanny Hartman's report was next. For background, she sketched on the threat of an American-Soviet war. Even though the official party line held that war was not inevitable, American imperialists, she said, were plotting a war against the Soviet Union, and in proof she offered the statements of private citizens who loosely advocated drastic atom bomb measures to forestall Soviet aggression. These same plotters, she declared, owned and controlled the means of war production, and thus held in their hands the entire war potential of the United States. The major weapons in their possession were the big key industries, and it was around these decisive plants and factories that the nation's war apparatus revolved. Although it was nearly submerged in a strong counterpoint, the theme of the conference now began to round out, and I sat up to take notice. The Communist Party, even in its secret and semi-secret meetings, always managed to protect itself by skirting around the absolute point it is trying to drive home. But it circles the central issue enough, chipping away at the edges, to leave no doubt in the mind of the trained communist that the point is there, and just what it is. "What are these basic industries?" Fanny declared, falling into the Marxist habit of framing a question to hold a ready-made answer. One of them, she said, was the big General Electric Company plant at Lynn, Massachusetts, where the government was engaged, and this was news to me, in the manufacture of jet engines for aircraft. Others were the railroad yards, communications, including radio, telegraph, telephone, and even the newspapers, the steel industry, shipyards, textiles, chemicals, and all the heavy industries which were involved in the increasing tempo of the defense establishment. Fanny and the other speakers told the conference that it was urgently necessary for the Communist Party to increase its strength in these industries in order to counteract the headlong rush toward the imperialist war. They did not say just how the party members were to accomplish this mission. That was left up in the air, at least for the time being, for each to determine for himself. Otis Hood took the platform next and resumed where Fanny Hartman left off. He used a new term, one I had never before heard in all of my party activities: colonizers. A party colonizer, he declared, was a devoted member who could be assigned party tasks in an important plant, or, if not already strategically placed, he would willingly give up his job in a non-essential industry or profession and move into one of the decisive basic industries. Here, his primary task would be to surround himself with a solid phalanx of Communist Party members, and through them to exercise his influence in the spreading of Marxism and the sharpening of economic and social struggles among the communist and non-communist workers alike. "The colonizer," I recall Hood saying, "will be elevated to a position of highest honor in the ranks of the Communist Party." During the long day's program, the details of this new industrial colonization program were worked out to the subordination of the normal methods of building party membership. Although this was supposed to have been a party builders conference, my old friend Nat Mills was designated as one of the colonizers at the General Electric plant in Lynn, together with Don Tormey, who was already prominent there as a labor organizer. Nat later gave up his home in Malden and moved to Lynn to be closer to his job. Dave Bennett was assigned to the steel industry in Massachusetts. Gus Johnson, a carpenter by trade, shifted his work to the yards and shops at the Boston and Maine Railroad. The United Office and Professional Workers Union of the CIO had a delegate present who was informed that its decisive area was in financial business and that its critical point of concentration was in the big life insurance companies, notably the John Hancock Life Insurance Company of Boston. Puzzled over the relationship between this emphasis on vital industries and the questionnaire I had typed and duplicated for Boone Shermer a few nights earlier, I spotted Boone during one of the brief recesses. He was in conversation with a delegate I did not know and fingering a sheaf of papers in his hand. I passed them as close as I could get without daring to stop and talk to them. Neither one noticed me. "I want all three of these back," I heard Boone say. "Don't mail them. Get them to me personally." I walked out of earshot. The heaviest colonization program carried out in the New England district under Boone's direction was in the General Electric plant, which coincidentally was one of the biggest defense plants in the region. I promptly reported the colonization plan to Hal Leary at the FBI, together with all the names I could muster, and the additional information that smaller, industry-wide conferences were to be called on the basis of plans set up at the Boston meeting. After the February meeting, I sat in on several informal discussions at district headquarters with Manny Blum and Boone Shermer. There I learned just how far the party expected to go in its membership drive. Manny held that the party did not require, and more than that, did not want, a majority at any level to carry out its mission. This sounded to me like a contradiction, until Manny explained it. The Communist Party must be, and must remain, the vanguard, the leaders of the working class, he said. They must represent the most advanced section of the workers and not seek to embrace the entire working class. To do so would merely be to dissipate our energies. Marxism shows us how to direct the struggle of the workers towards socialism. Comrade Stalin points out correctly that only a party that has thoroughly mastered Marxist-Leninist science can go forward with confidence toward the goal. But we cannot fill the ranks of the party with undisciplined numbers who make no determined effort to master Marx. To do so would weaken the party and deprive it of the leadership that is necessary. I wanted to be certain that I understood. Therefore, I summarized, the Communist Party will always remain a minority. I had in mind the reaction of most Americans who disparage the efforts of the Communist movement because of their small representation. Exactly, Manny replied, bristling with the confidence of one whose Marxist science is firmly grounded. When did you ever hear of an effective group that had more leaders than followers? Even in a people's democracy such as the Soviet Union, the Communist Party is a small minority. The industry-wide discussions, I learned subsequently, were held as they were outlined at the conference. They were small secret meetings, most of them held away from party headquarters. Their purpose was to go into further detail on the colonization program, taking each particular industry in the district plant by plant and shop by shop to study progress. Only the key leaders of the plan attended these meetings. As a white-collar worker, I attended none of them. But I gathered from the district conference and from reports of the industry meetings, which filtered down to me, that it was plain that the colonization program of the party was a matter of highest priority through the communist apparatus. In a subsequent investigation conducted by the U.S. Committee on Un-American Activities, it was learned that some of the communists with college degrees and technical training were ordered to conceal their education backgrounds on their employment applications in order to obtain jobs inside the critical defense plants as ordinary laborers. The reluctant witnesses who appeared before the committee refused to reveal whether the purpose of their colonization was for Soviet espionage or for intelligence or for sabotage. But it was most certainly not for party building, since they had concealed their communist membership as well as their professional skills. Further, it was particularly evident that this effort was to be concentrated in essential industries, essential not only to the economy, but to the military defense of the United States. Now, this is an interesting chapter. I mean, essentially the chapter's titled Espionage because that's what they're doing. They're setting up these colonization programs where they're going inside the industry of the day, specifically targeting industries that relate to the military defense of the United States. And who do we know, or rather, what entity do we know today that is doing this at all levels? Whether that's physically infiltrating a business or just hacking into them, hacking into their network, that would be China. China's doing exactly this right now. And it's not with the focus of turning people or building a communist influence with inside the business. In fact, none of this really, if you look at it, do we really see an effort to turn the place into a communist stronghold, these businesses. They just wanted people in the inside. One big thing that jumped out at me was where it says it clearly pointed the way to socialism, which party teachers said in secret sessions could only come about by violent revolution carried out by bands of armed workers. And Fabian socialism, the party traditionally held, is but the first step to communism. Fabian socialism. Barack Obama was a Fabian socialist. And it's essentially what it is. It's like a secret socialist, a hidden socialist, where you're not going to tell people about it. Forbes defines Fabian socialists in an article as, Fabians believed in gradual nationalization of the economy through manipulation of the democratic process. Breaking away from the violent revolutionary socialists of the day, they thought that the only real way to effect fundamental change and social justice was through a mass movement of the working class presided over by intellectual and cultural elites. So socialism is Marxism. It's all the same thing. And it's kind of Fabian socialism is kind of what we were talking about what the book is talking about with Browderism, with this idea that you can go along to get along and to foster socialism, but it's a little more radical than that. But that jumped out at me when it said that Fabian socialism is a real thing, and it's a real thing today. There are people who are Fabian socialists, and they still hide it. They're not out there telling you what they are, but that's what they are. Barack Obama was one, I'm sure. Kamala Harris is one. So they use the bureaucracy and they balloon up the size of government, create a big bureaucracy, break things. And that's what I've been thinking about as far as communism. It's all about disruption. So once again, an insight thanks to Herb Philbrick. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode and remind you that you were not made to fit in, you were born to stand out. Go stand out this week. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.